Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 29th of January. This hour of the program, The Long War, we'll be talking with the managing editor of The Long War, who has been looking at significant developments the past year and exploring what's been going on in terms of terror in Afghanistan, in Iran and Somalia, Pakistan, etc. He is president of the Public Multimedia, a nonprofit organization, the mission to provide reporting and analysis of the long war, an adjunct fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, a contributor to the Weekly Standard, and he also has served as a signalman and infantryman in the U.S. Army and the New Jersey National Guard, was embedded, actually, with the U.S. Marine Corps, the U.S. Army, the Georgia Army, the Iraqi Army, and the Iraqi Police, and with the Canadian Army in Afghanistan, and presents regularly at the U.S. Air Force Contemporary Counterinsurgency Warfare School on the media and embedded reporting. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Bill Raggio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, we figured out how to do that for a while, and that's talk@wpr.org. And Bill, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Kathleen, and thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
Pleasure to speak with you.
Yeah, our pleasure. I was listening to NPR on the way to work yesterday morning, and I want to start with this with you just because it's foremost in my mind, this really incredible story about how hours before President Obama took the oath of office, the FBI had word from overseas a possible terrorist attack linked to a Somali hardline jihadist group. And then we find out that there are at least a dozen Somali young teenagers, actually, 16, 17 years old, who have disappeared from Minneapolis in the past year. And FBI is worried they're training in Somalia and could end up returning to this country to launch a terrorist attack. What do you know about this?
Yeah, the report of the attempted assassination or the attack during the inauguration, that was actually, they believe that that's a hoax or it hasn't been confirmed yet. But the news of the Somalis Somali Americans going over to Somalia to join a radical Islamist group called Shabaab, which is essentially Al Qaeda's affiliate in Somalia. This is very troubling. I've heard numbers anywhere from two dozen to 40. Somali Americans going over there. One of them has conducted a suicide attack in Puntland or Somaliland, which is our two semi-autonomous governments in northern Somalia. And one has been seen on one of Shabaab's videos. These videos are produced by Al Qaeda. So this is very troubling because what we have is, the most troubling aspect of this to me is that we have a recruiting network up there in Minnesota that is very active, been able to recruit these men, get them indoctrinated, get them overseas, and get them connected with terrorist groups operating in Somalia. This is very troubling. I mean, we only know the tip of the iceberg of this story right now.
How in the world would you recruit these students? And what's ironic is these are students who were brought here, I believe, by Lutheran Social Services to escape terror in Somalia.
Yeah, that's sort of one of the most troubling aspects of this as well. I mean, they apparently, and that they're being recruited through a local mosque there in the city. The imam of the mosque denies this, but there's been links back to this one mosque to a radical Islamist who's also who also served prison time as well. So the FBI is still looking into this story, I still don't think we know the full scope of it, but we do know that Somali Americans have gone into Somalia to conduct terrorist attacks. There's also reports from northern Somalia, I just saw this today, that 11 Somali Americans have been detained and they've been smuggling anti-aircraft missiles into northern Somaliland. I haven't confirmed this yet, but these reports are popping up. These Americans are starting to pop up over there in Somalia.
Hmm. You have written that Pakistan is central when we look at the war against Al Qaeda and the Taliban. What's the centrality of Pakistan?
The problem with Pakistan is that you have a weak government, I believe that the Pakistani government, if it had its choice, would not allow these terror groups to operate on its soil. What you have in Pakistan is you have a plethora, an alphabet soup of terror groups operating from there. The Lashkar-e-Taiba, which is junior in Southeast Asia, in Southern Asia. They're the ones that conducted the attack on Mumbai. They've been behind dozens of bombings and large-scale bombings inside of India. You have groups like Lashkar-e-Jhangvi. You've got a whole slew of groups that fight in Kashmir. And then you have the Taliban and Al-Qaeda that have consolidated their power in Pakistan's northwest and in regions in Balochistan, in the areas bordering Afghanistan. The Pakistani government is powerless to stop them. And within the military and in the intelligence service, the Inter Service Intelligence Agency inside Pakistan, there are significant elements that either has turned a blind eye to this or actively supporting these groups. There have been very credible reports of the ISI actually helicoptering in supplies into Afghanistan while U.S. troops are conducting a battle. Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel had confirmed this, and my sources tell me that this is extremely accurate. This is what you have. Al-Qaeda has its base. They have, I'm told, 157 training camps. That was as of last summer. I'm sure we've taken some of these down in these Predator strikes, but some of these are really transitory. So the instability, everyone says that Afghanistan is the central front, and I completely disagree with this. Mm. It's Pakistan. This is the wellspring of problems. Afghanistan was, going on a pretty decent path until about 2004, when Al-Qaeda and the Taliban started regenerating in the tribal areas, in Pakistani tribal areas, and then they started pushing their bombers and their fighters, and they trained and recruited and pushed them all into Afghanistan. So this is the real front in the war. This is where everything comes from, and this is the hardest problem for the Obama administration to address.
Mm-hmm. And the new government in Pakistan, after Musharraf resigned, is having difficulty, you believe, in reining in the Inter-Service Intelligence Agency and fighting the Taliban. What's their problem?
Yeah, well, the Pakistani military has been the real power behind the Pakistani government for decades. There's been numerous coups there. Musharraf spent 8 years as president, as well as the commander of the chief of staff of the Pakistani military. And the Inter-Service Intelligence Agency, it has it, and the military as well, they have their fingers in all the pies. I mean, they own businesses. They have they actually have a political division within the Inter-Service Intelligence Agency, which conducts political activities inside Pakistan. They have become a state within a state. They exercise what I believe to be the real power inside Pakistan. The government last year, they tried to put the Inter-Service Intelligence Agency directly under the command of the Prime Minister, and within one day of announcing this, it was squashed. I mean, that tells you, and it was squashed by the Pakistani military, that tells you who's really calling the shots there.
What about the U.S. airstrikes? We have more of them in 2008. Are they effective? Do we know?
Yeah, in 2007, they took out, by my count, seven senior al-Qaeda leaders. What we're targeting there is U.S. intelligence is frightened that the next attack against either the United States or the West, the next 9/11-type attack or Madrid or London-type attack, I know that those are smaller in scale, but we do not want these attacks occurring. They believe that it's going to occur it's going to take place, planned, plotted, and the bombers and whatnot will be trained in Pakistan's tribal areas. So we're going after what they call Al-Qaeda's external network. So this is the network that sets this up. It goes from the recruiting to the training to actually providing the logistics for them. We've taken out seven senior commanders, and this year we took out two more. Two of these guys were behind the Kenya and Tanzania bombings in 1998. So it's important to take down these networks. It keeps Al-Qaeda back on its heels. They have to be concerned more about things like operational security, about not getting killed, as opposed to being able to actively train. Now, Al-Qaeda is going to replace these people But over time, it's difficult. You know, they don't have an endless pool of talent. And also, we have to understand that this is a very closely knit organization, and it's very secretive. And you just, you know, so not everybody is within the ranks. And you might have 1,000 or 2,000 core senior Al Qaeda people that are in there that they can recruit from. And it's very difficult. They have operational security problems when they start reaching outside of that center.
And what makes you believe that the next attack is being planned in those areas? Why not other parts of the world?
Well, because almost every major either attack or plotted attack that's been foiled has been traced back to Pakistan. The Madrid attacks, the London attacks, the Mumbai attacks, even then there are some traces back into Pakistan's northwest. A whole series of the airliner plot, in 2006 London airline plot, that was traced back to Pakistan. Pakistan's northwest frontier province. All of these attacks, or intelligence services can get their fingers back into either north or south Waziristan, Bajor, Khyber, all these tribal agencies where al-Qaeda maintains their camps.
Let's go to Afghanistan for a moment, where the Taliban seems to be getting stronger and their actions are atrocious. The new president has talked about sending, I believe by this summer, another 30,000 troops to that part of the world. Do you think that's a good idea, and why is the Taliban strengthening?
Yeah, well, I'll answer the second part of that question first. The Taliban is strengthening in largely for just two reasons here. You have a weak central government that has been very corrupt and has not fulfilled the needs of the people on the ground. They haven't fulfilled their promises, and the corruption is angering the people in a lot of areas, as well as they've not been able to provide the security for them. The growth of the Afghan security forces has been, particularly the army, has been very slow. And the army is a respected institution, but the police forces there are widely seen as corrupt. There's a lot more police, and when they come in, they're setting up roadblocks and taking money from people and things like that. Very corrupt activities that really turns people against them. And the other reason is what you have across the border inside of Pakistan. So when the Taliban, they have access to funding, they raise taxes there, they have recruiting centers, they can take them and train them as a military. The Taliban in Afghanistan, as well as in Pakistan, is fighting in military formations, not doing it very well. When they go up against U.S. forces, they get beaten. But this tells you that they're developing the capacity to go beyond a terror group and to become a military-style group. And look, al-Qaeda had a military formation. It was called the 055 Brigade, which we destroyed during the invasion of Afghanistan. It's reformed itself, as long as with several other al-Qaeda military brigades. So what you have, you couple the corruptions, the problems in governance and security with the active sanctuary, basically the Cambodia of 2000 of the 21st century inside of Pakistan, and you have a real problem. Now, do I think that adding more troops will make a difference? If they're used properly, yes. I have a lot of problems with the way the military has conducted its counterinsurgency plan in Afghanistan. I don't think that, you know, and a lot of this stems from working with NATO, from working in a coalition. What you have is you have countries that operate in very different ways. They're called caveats. So, like, you maybe, so in a case like, I'll give you an example, Spain, which operates in northwestern Afghanistan or western Afghanistan, they're not allowed to send their troops into the hot areas, into the south and east, Germany, Italy, the same type thing. So you have, you know, some of these countries don't allow their troops to go out at night. They don't allow them to fight at night. They, you know, you have all these caveats which really make it hard to fight. And then we're not getting the troops out there in a lot of instances to provide the local security that's required, and there's not enough of them. So I say yes, it's a good thing to add more troops if we have the counterinsurgency strategy right. I'm not so sure that we do. And in any case, all we can do is tamp down the violence in Afghanistan. We can keep a lid on it. I don't think Afghanistan will ever truly be secured and be resolved until we resolve that problem in Pakistan.
We're going to take phone calls, and we'll do that in just one moment. Bill Raggio is our guest this hour, managing editor of the Long War Journal. And he is an adjunct fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. He's a contributor to the Weekly Standard and has a long career in the military and as an embedded reporter as well. He served as a signalman and infantryman in the U.S. Army and the New Jersey National Guard, and also embedded with the U.S. Marine Corps, the U.S. Army, the Georgia Army, the Iraqi Army, and the Iraqi Police, and the Canadian Army in Afghanistan. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We figured out a way to get an email to us, so if you'd like to send an email, that's talk at WPR.org, talk at WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls, and let's start with Ray from Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Hi, Kathleen. Good morning to your guest. I am just very disturbed by the way your guest is talking this morning. He said we've killed seven leaders of Al-Qaeda, but he neglects to report that we also killed large groups of these people's families in these compounds where we're dropping 2,000-pound bombs on mud huts to get one person. We might kill 40 or 50 people in that village. Now, all we're doing there is recruiting more fighters in the future, but my main thing I want to talk about here is when a small enemy is fighting a larger enemy, for instance, in a judo match, the smaller person wants the larger one to overreact, which takes the larger person off balance, enabling a smaller person to take down a larger person. And I want to suggest that this is exactly what is being played out here. We have overreacted in every way on this so-called war on terror. And just proof of it is the highest suicide rates ever amongst American soldiers. Why? Because of what they are being forced to do over there, killing women and children. Whether or not you think that they have the right to do it is not the point. They are doing this. It's collateral damage. And when we and the Israelis are killing them, it's never, ever called terror. When to live there and to be experiencing the onslaught of smart weapons, drone planes over you at all times, and missiles coming out of the sky, if that's not terror, I don't know what it is. If we had fought this more with our minds by sending books and food to these poor people around the world, we would already have an army of Muslims ready to fight for us.
Okay, let's get a response. Bill?
Well, I respectfully would say that that is an extremely naive look at the way this war is being prosecuted. If you want, first of all, U.S. troops are not being forced to do anything. We have a volunteer military, and I have gone out. I've spent months and months with U.S. troops. I have never seen our troops do anything to violate the laws of war. I served as a soldier myself, so I understand this. But second, if you think that we could just send books and food into the northwest frontier province of Pakistan and that will defeat the Taliban, you know, I don't really have an answer for you other than you just don't understand the dynamics of the situation. Yes, there are going to be civilians killed. It is collateral damage. It is, and it's horrific. But the reality is, if we do not take down Al-Qaeda's leaders, if we don't target this external network, we will suffer another attack like we had suffered on 9/11 in London, in Madrid, and elsewhere. I read a very interesting article in the Pakistani press the other day. We always say every Pakistani despises these airstrikes. A Pakistani journalist went out there and talked to people in the Northwest Frontier Province, and what he said was people were telling him, we hope that they continue these airstrikes because these people are oppressing us. They're making us live under a strict version of Islamic law that they have no desire to live under. They're forced to give their sons up to fight in wars that they don't want to fight. They're forced to pay high amounts of their own money to fund Taliban operations. Look, there is no such thing as a bloodless war. I don't like it, and U.S. troops don't like killing women and children. But the reality is we did not start this war. We were attacked on 9/11. About almost 3,000 Americans were killed, and we suffered almost $1 trillion worth of damage based on what happened in New York City. And we have to have a response. There is just no two ways about it.
Let me do a follow-up to this, though. We've done programs with people who know Pakistan pretty well and have spent a lot of time in that country and have deep concerns that development, money that should have been targeted to development, has A, not been sufficient, and B, has been probably misused by Pakistani authorities. Don't you believe that some amount of money, and maybe a goodly amount of money, needs to go to improving the quality of people's lives, schools and water and roads, et cetera, and we might be able to do a better job in that regard?
I could not agree with you more, Kathleen. The estimated 5-point-something billion that was sent over to Pakistan, almost 3.8 billion is completely, and this was actually as of, I believe, February or March of last year. I don't have the current numbers. Almost 3.8 billion is completely unaccounted for. And you know, and the reason is because we gave it to the Pakistanis, to the Pakistani government, and, you know, without any form of oversight, and they just pocketed this money. They told us that they were going to fight against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. They haven't. They claim there's 100,000 troops in the Northwest Frontier Province. The Taliban controls most of the Northwest Frontier Province, and they've defeated the Pakistani military on the battlefield. I absolutely agree that we need to help improve the lives of the people of Pakistan and across the world. I'd also say that we also need to help open up these governments to have a more democratic system as well, to give people representation so that they can demand of their government better services, better schools and whatnot, instead of having a government like Pakistan that sits there and pockets all of their money that has gone back to A, to help fight the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and B, to help develop their lives. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's a two-pronged fight. We need to help. We need to lift the people up in the Muslim world. And look, I've embedded with the U.S. with the Iraqi army several times. This is what I like to do. I'm not a believer here that, you know, that we're in a war against Muslims or anything like that. You know, when the caller says that, you know, we're creating an army of enemies, well, in a place like Iraq, we've created an army that despises Al-Qaeda, that despises extremism. This is something that is not being reported on. Iraqi soldiers are volunteers. There is no draft, and they, unlike the United States, they can walk away from their job any day they like, and Iraqis are turned away from the military. And I've gone out with these guys, and they may not be as proficient as U.S. soldiers, but they go out there and they fight, and they give their lives fighting against Al-Qaeda and other Islamist groups in Iraq at a rate of 5 to 10 times U.S. forces.
So you think they're getting better?
Oh, are you talking about the proficiency?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Iraqi security forces between now and where things were in 2006, where it was dark. I mean, I don't believe it was a civil war. It was on the cusp of a civil war. To me, a civil war is when all institutions break down and you could have had the police fighting the army or elements of the police fighting elements of the police and whatnot. We didn't have that kind of situation, but we were close. And between now and 2 years, and I was in Iraq in 2005 and 2006, I've seen this. And between now, and I was in Mosul last March, you know, you have the Iraqi security forces are going out there and they're doing their job. And that is why we're able to draw down there.
Thanks, Ray, for the call. Let's go to Katie from Spooner. Hi, Katie.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hello, Bill.
Hello.
Bill, you really sound like you know what you're talking about. And we need to hear what you have to say. People need to hear this really bad. The reason Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, they are so bad. They're just so bad. What I need to know from you is, let's suppose that somebody who lives in Minnesota might think that she knows of a way in. This whole Somali thing is really scary. And how would that person go about contacting, like, I don't know, the FBI or the CIA or the good guys with this possible pathway in to
That's interesting, because I know that there have been people that have done this on their own. I can't remember. There was one woman that actually does this quite often, goes to mosques that have been identified as radical and recorded information and whatnot. I would say this is extremely dangerous to do if you're really going to try and get inside a circle and you don't have the support of a law enforcement agency. As far as if you're asking if you can volunteer to do work for the U.S. government, and you would have to work with the FBI. The CIA cannot work on U.S. soil. I don't know how receptive they would be to a regular citizen that wants to sort of go out and do. discussing here.
Yeah.
But possibly if you can give them information on what you do know about this and the way that you believe that they can get in there, that would be information that they would be receptive to. I mean, you would probably have to go. I would imagine the Minnesota branch of the FBI would be very interested in hearing any and all information that can help them crack this case.
Do you have information, Katie, or you want to just work to get some?
I think I know just a way in. I think I know of a pathway. I don't want to do anything myself. I'm not that brave, but I have an idea.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, then definitely contact the local law enforcement. I would contact the FBI directly. They're the people that are going to be working on this case.
Thanks, Katie, for your call. Let's go to Kevin from Green Bay. Hi, Kevin.
Good morning. How are you today?
Fine, you.
Wonderful. First off, I'd like to thank Public Radio for having this gentleman on. It's a nice, clear, different path, and we have some different views. And I would like to thank him for what he's done in the military and out of the military. And for the first caller who said that we need to bring books and hospitals, this is true. But before we can do that, we have to get rid of the enemy, because if you bring the books and the hospitals and the doctors and the teachers in, they will be murdered. The Russians learned that the hard way. And we've learned that the hard way the first 7-8 years we've been in Afghanistan. The troops that are in Iraq now, they don't kill men and women. That is just ungodly that person could say that. They're the bravest, honorable soldiers that we have. And believe me, the ones that have been in Iraq have already been in Afghanistan once or twice, too. The experience we've learned in Iraq will help us in Afghanistan. But we need to get in there, and we need to get it cleaned up. But we can't do anything good until we get rid of the evil. Thank you very much.
Kevin, you're absolutely correct. You need to provide security first. There are numerous instances where we've felt that an area was secured and we've gone and built schools and built clinics, and the enemy will come in and destroy these clinics and these schools. This has happened numerous times in both in Iraq and in Afghanistan. One of the things we did in Iraq with the whole Awakening/Sons of Iraq program. Now, look, I've witnessed this personally. Everyone wants to say, oh, we just paid off insurgents and we're just paying them for their time. These were people in their local communities that were horrified by what Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda's Islamist allies were doing in their own countries, subjugating their women, doing crazy things like not allowing cucumbers and tomatoes to be together on the same vegetable stand. Because it was of some strange sexual idea of the fruits, cutting people's hands off for smoking cigarettes. So, you know, these groups, when you have real opposition to these groups, that's when you're really able to provide that level of security where you can get the school and you can get the clinic open. And once these are open, it's extremely successful. But without security, there is, you know, the books will be burned, the clinics will be destroyed, and anyone, doctors and whatnot, they'll be killed. In Pakistan, in the northwestern Tier province, in a place called Swat, not in the tribal areas, but what they call a settled district. Think of it as one of your counties there in Wisconsin. This is an area where the Taliban, they have defeated the Pakistani military. They've destroyed 300 schools. They routinely murder people, hang them, dig up tribal leaders' bodies who dare to oppose them, and hang them from posts in the towns, and the townsmen are terrified to even pull that body down and bury it. This is, you know, without security, nothing can happen.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. What do you think of Iraq's decision, the news today, that they are not going to be renewing Blackwater contracts for security, et cetera?
Yeah, I say kudos to Iraq. Iraq is an independent country, and they're certainly allowed to make decisions like these. I think a lot of the reporting on security contractors is quite overblown, in my estimation, having been out there, seen security contractors at work. Most of the 95% of the contractors never leave a U.S. post. They're cooks. They're doing laundry. They're doing maintenance around the bases and whatnot. Blackwater is, you know, in the case, they're providing security for the U.S. State Department. And the reason they're providing the security for the U.S. State Department is because the State Department declined the U.S. military protection. So, you know, so it's kind of interesting. Everyone wants to say, well, you know, why isn't the military doing this, or why do we have Blackwater? Well, we have Blackwater there because State Department won't accept these groups. But the reality is, too, is to do things like to get reporters out there, to get aid out there from non-governmental organizations, they do need security. You know, again, security is key for them to go out to places where they can, you know, provide the services that's required. And to do that, you know, a non-governmental organization does not want to work with the U.S. military. I can understand and I can respect this because they don't want to be seen as a party to the conflict. I think it's a very naive approach, but that's fine. I respect their decision to have that belief. So if they want to get out there and provide the services, they're going to need security, and security contractors are required. But look, if Iraq doesn't want Blackwater or Triple Canopy or any of these other contractors in their country, they are a sovereign state, and they can say no.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Bill from Windsor. Hi, Bill.
Good morning, Kathleen, and again, another wonderful program.
Thanks, Bill.
You are the best. My question for Bill is, where is the funding for Al-Qaeda and I suppose the Taliban coming from? What are the sources, and what are we doing, if we can, to cut off these sources of funding?
Sure, that's a great question, Bill. There's various sources from around the world. They raise money in the West here and in Europe, but the largest source of funding comes from what's called the Golden Chain. This is a network of very wealthy individuals. Some even will even say they're members of the Saudi royal family and other royal families within the Gulf states. They provide the bulk of the financing for Al-Qaeda's activities throughout the world. They provide the financing for activities in Afghanistan. Also within Afghanistan, you have a major portion of that conflict funded by the poppy trade there as well. So the one thing the enemy is getting very good at is developing its indigenous sources of fundraising. In Pakistan, they're levying taxes against the locals. In Afghanistan, they're doing it through the poppies, and then this poppy money is being pushed back into Pakistan to help fund the camps and whatnot. But that golden chain that exists in the Gulf, this is something I think that this is one of our real failures in the war, is the inability to tackle these funding networks. We know some of the individuals, and yet they're untouchable. I think that the U.S. Treasury Department, though, has done a very good job. This is Stuart Levy and he's actually been asked to stay on in the Obama administration. Kudos to the Obama administration. This guy has gone on a personal crusade to dig out who these groups are and designate them as terrorists. Groups or individuals, designate them as terrorists. And what this does is it stops U.S. businesses and individuals from doing businesses with these terrorist suppliers. And sometimes they're terrorist people, they're terrorist entities, or they can just be financiers. So this is what it's very important. I still think it's probably too small of a step. But, you know, what else are we going to do if we know, you know, this is where the real conundrum in this war is. Okay, so we know there's some financiers inside Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Arabian government is going to do nothing about it. What do we do?
Mm-hmm.
That's the question. What do we do about this? Do we go to war with Saudi Arabia? Do we target these men with assassinations? Do we continually try to bang our head against the wall and get the Saudis to deport them? You know, these are the questions that, you know, that 7 years plus years into this war, we still have no answers to.
Right. And we never really dealt with it when it was determined that most of the people who committed those acts of horror were from Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely correct. I mean, you know, people, you know, one of the things, the criticism I hear about Iraq or Afghanistan is, you know, we've pointed our guns at the wrong place. Well, we should have gone to war with Saudi Arabia, or we should have gone to war here or gone to war there. I never thought that Iraq was the best place to start with after Afghanistan. But, you know, I think we made the commitment to go there. And I actually think within, you know, in the next decade, if the progress goes as it's going, that it'll be a very positive thing. And one of the things that isn't being reported at all is that awakening that formed in Western Iraq, and this is going to tie back to Saudi Arabia, that's a grouping of tribes in the Anbar province. Well, these tribes don't just sit in Iraq. They have links across the border into Afghanistan. So what we've developed for ourselves is this network, this transnational network of tribals that are essentially are very willing to help root out al-Qaeda. So this may be an option for us to take on the Saudis. Yep, we've decided that the Saudis are our allies. I don't want to say joke, this isn't a funny topic, but, our friends, the Saudis, the Saudis do arrest senior al-Qaeda operatives and whatnot, but then they allow all of this stuff to happen on their soil as well. It's just like Pakistan. It's quite a very imperfect ally. But what are we to do? I mean, do we want to declare war on a country that says it's willing to help us? Again, the questions that we still haven't answered.
We're going to welcome more phone calls. We'll take them in a moment. Thanks very much, Bill, for your call. A line open at 800-486-8655. And we are checking the email today. So if you'd like to send an email, that's talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is the number. Derek from Round Lake is next. Hello, Derek.
Yes, good morning. Good show. Listening to your guest, I am having really mixed feelings about how this issue is really being addressed, because I think his embedded opinions represent this type of talking point punditry, which I think is very misleading. Basically, the biggest issue in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and I spoke with Afghani and Iraqi people, mostly refugees in Sweden, is the lack of total legitimacy of the occupation-led government. Look at the Karzai, his oil industry connections, namely Unocal and Chevron. So the Khalizade, who was a U.S. ambassador to the country, and that he was actually transferred to Iraq at the same time before Mr. Crocker. Also, another issue is the image of the coalition forces fighting in Afghanistan as a stellar forebearers of peace and development is somewhat misleading. 3 years ago, a Polish unit under American command has massacred villagers, and there was a very interesting trial in Poland, which actually was concluded just about 6 months ago, and American government and American high command in charge of the area refused absolutely any cooperation with the investigating authorities. So the question I would have to your guest is that how can you form any opinions about what's really going on in the region? You don't know the culture. You don't know the language.
Well, he's been there. He's spent a lot of time in the countries.
Being embedded, frankly, I only can tell opinion of what's really going on in the region, specifically listening to the BBC, to a lot of international media sources. If you really want to know what's going on in northwest Pakistan, I suggest you talk to Mr. Ahmed Rashid, who's a very well-known journalist, and he actually wrote a book about the issue itself, specifically about Taliban. So I think, having this type of opinions formed by someone who really is embedded first, so therefore is his own opinions is already skewered, I think it's very unprofessional as well as dishonest. Thank you.
Well, I would respond to that by saying, do you think that Ahmed Rashid doesn't have his own opinions or any other reporter? The one thing I would say, look, first of all, I'm going to agree with the caller. I do think that the Karzai government is seen as being illegitimate. And as I mentioned earlier in the conversation, there's a lot of problems with that. In Iraq, that is not the case. The Iraqis, that election was a very positive thing for the Iraqis. They have seen the government by and large as being legitimate. They're going to hold provincial elections now. One of the things I have done, and I explained this earlier, I've gone out with the Iraqi army. I'm not talking about going out with the U.S. troops. I've spent time with the Iraqis fighting this war. And a lot of them can speak English, and if they can't, I have an interpreter that can speak with me. I spend a lot of time with them, and understand their opinions. When you're embedded, you get to hit the streets and talk to the Iraqi people themselves. Sometimes they'll be honest with you. Sometimes they won't. It all depends, but it's no different from another reporter hitting the streets outside of the military. So, and as far as the Northwest Frontier Province goes, I'm going to have to tout my work here a little bit. I was able, based on my reporting on the Northwest Frontier Province, and yes, I have never been to northwestern Pakistan, but I have studied it in depth. I was able to predict the timing and order of the peace agreements that occurred in 2006, 2007, and 2008. I track this. I read the Pakistani media copiously. They have an excellent, excellent English language news, Daily Times, Dawn, the news. You know, I could sit down, you know, I could sit down here and go down a list of Pakistani news sources. I read it every day. I have people that I speak to in Pakistan on a regular basis. The readers of my website, they will. I have Pakistanis that come through, and yes, I can trace based on their IP address where they're writing from, and tell me you are absolutely correct. This is what is happening where I live here in northwestern Pakistan. So I'll stand by my work. You know, I would suggest that you go over to longwarjournal.org and give it a read, and see what you think.
And we had an email coming in. Please tell us how we can keep up on your information. So that's longwarjournal.com?
.org. Yeah, we're calling
.org, sorry.
Well.
Okay. And that's where people can find the information. All right. Thanks very much for the call. And let us go to Jonathan from Appleton next. Hi, Jonathan.
Good morning. Thank you for the program.
Uh-huh.
I've been trying to figure out how to phrase this question. The only thing I can come up with is what I realize that you're probably in favor of most of the actions that we took in Iraq and are considering taking in Afghanistan. My question to people who are in favor of what we've been doing has always been, what did we do wrong over there, in your opinion, that we need to change, that would be easy enough to change to make things go better?
Yeah, you know,
I'll take my answer off.
Okay.
Have a grateful day.
Thanks.
Thank you, sir. That's a great question. I think I'll be the first to tell you because I've seen these firsthand. We have made mistakes in this war. Absolutely. I think one of the things we have to understand that any endeavor as complex as war is not going to go perfectly. There are going to be problems at the outset. We were dealing with a military that was geared to fight in conventional war at the beginning of this conflict, and I think we saw that with both Iraq and Afghanistan. We thought that we can easily eject these governments and put in a new government, and then peace would break out. Well, that just did not happen, neither in Iraq or in Afghanistan. We had to learn the hard way that we had to do a little bit more than just knocking off Saddam Hussein or knocking off the Taliban off their seat of power. We have to do something about that. You know, when Colin Powell says, you know, you break it, you own it. You know, I agree with him. He's absolutely right. He understood intuitively that we need to do a little bit more. In Iraq, we were not geared to fight an insurgency. In Iraq, the intelligence, basically the CIA here, refused to recognize that we were fighting an insurgency in Iraq in 2003. And by the time we recognized that the insurgency coalesced, well, guess what? This happens in just about every insurgency. Why it's not just the military, it's the State Department, you know, it's our national leadership. Why we don't study history and understand what is in front of us is beyond me. I mean, it was clear to me by the summer of 2003 that we were in the midst of an insurgency in Iraq, and we did not address that until sometime in 2004. And even then, we got the strategy wrong. We never really got it right. And look, in parts of Iraq, we were doing it properly. The Marines in Anbar, I spent a lot of time out in Anbar province. The Marines were fighting a counterinsurgency. The problem is in the neighboring provinces, Saladin and Nineveh, and whatnot, where the insurgency was strong, they weren't fighting a counterinsurgency. So the terrorists could go back and forth from these regions and attack U.S. forces and resupply and reequip and whatnot. So, you know, I would definitely say one of our biggest failures is to learn from history to understand what is going on. But I think that we need to look at these wars in a historical preference, light. And look, I'm going to say this coming from I served as an infantryman. The loss of the life of every soldier means something to me. The loss of life of civilians does as well. But there are some things that are worth fighting for, and you don't have an army, and you don't send an army to go to deploy somewhere if you don't want them to be killed. There are going to be casualties on all sides. I think that we've been overly risk averse in some cases, and what this has done has actually led to more casualties. When we decided that, hey, we're going to keep our troops on the bases because if they're not off the base, then they can't be killed. And yeah, you know, when the lowest amount of U.S. casualties occurred in early 2006 when they decided to keep the troops on the base and let the Iraqi security forces who weren't prepared go out there and handle things. All that did was allow the insurgency and al-Qaeda and all these groups to metastasize, and they became more powerful. So then when we did decide to take them on, our casualty rates went up. So you know, and you could take that information and apply it to Afghanistan just as well.
Yeah. I want to ask you a little bit about recruitment and find out what you know about this. I'm wondering, what are the tools now that al-Qaeda is using to get people to join their cause, and has the recruitment message changed?
Yeah, al-Qaeda is very adept at using the new media, using the internet, creating video and whatnot that and audio that can be distributed via cell phones, distributing discs that has this information and whatnot. They've been very adept at that. It has worked. It worked. You know, but I think if we look at the numbers and in Afghanistan and in Iraq and in other theaters. When the Mujahideen, not Al Qaeda, not the Taliban, they didn't exist in the 1980s. When they fought the Soviets, tens of thousands were flocking into Afghanistan to fight them, and it's only estimated that thousands are doing that in both Iraq and in Afghanistan. So I think that their message hasn't been quite as effective as it was. And again, a little different situations here because you didn't have al-Qaeda and the Taliban doing the recruiting. But, you know, there was a much greater desire to fight the Russians in Afghanistan than to fight the U.S. and allied forces in Afghanistan in Iraq. Has their messaging changed? I haven't seen much of a change in their messaging based on the internet. I mean, they've essentially stuck to this line of, you know, it is your duty as a Muslim. This is what Islam is about. Your duty is to fight jihad, and you know the West are the occupiers. They're coming in the Muslim lands. We need to restore the caliphate. You're being oppressed by your government. Those messages have been coming through from 2001 until today.
Mm-hmm. Saeed from Green Bay is next. Hi, Saeed.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I think a point that your speaker made in response to the caller that was concerned about collateral damage, it needs to be reiterated. And as your speaker said, this is not at its core a war between Islam and the West, but fundamentally it is a confrontation or struggle within Islam between the majorities who are progressive and interpret Islam in a way consistent with modern life, and a minority, a powerful minority, that interprets Islam in a fashion not consistent with modernity and is radical and backward looking. The before there was 9/11, the first victims of radical Islam were Muslims. Who can forget the joy that Afghans felt when the Taliban were dejected, or the atrocities that these governments commit in the name of Islam? So the first victim of radical Islam is other Muslims. And from that it follows that our best ally in the fight against radical Islam are Muslims, are moderate Muslims. And another caller invoked the work of Ahmad Rashid, which I am very familiar with on the Taliban. Ahmad Rashid would completely agree with the analysis that your speaker has put forth regarding Pakistan. That's my point.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Well, yeah, thank you, Sam. Yeah, that is a point I didn't make. I do believe that Mr. Rashid would agree with my analysis on Pakistan. But Kathleen, first, I just want to commend your callers for very, very knowledgeable, very intelligent questions and opinions here, even the ones I don't agree with. I think that Syed is absolutely correct. This is a war within Islam, not a war with Islam. Absolutely correct. More Muslims have been killed by al-Qaeda and the Taliban and their allied terrorist groups in the world than the U.S. has ever done. I mean, look at, if 100,000 were killed in Iraq, the vast majority of these were killed by al-Qaeda and their allied groups. Same thing within Afghanistan. The numbers came out just recently in Afghanistan. About, I think they estimate around 1,100 civilians were killed in Afghanistan last year. That's terrible. But, you know, again, in the context of greater wars where we had millions of killed, you know, in wars, only 100 of those were killed in accidental strikes by the U.S. The U.S. does not intentionally target. I can tell you this. I've been in operation centers. I've been out with the troops. They go out of their way not to do it, even at the risk of their lives. The Taliban has been responsible for 973 civilian deaths. They intentionally target civilians. They throw acid in the face of girls trying to go to school. They burn down schools. They conduct suicide attacks while school children are walking by to try and kill U.S. soldiers or Afghan soldiers or Afghan police. This is the nature of the enemy. I don't think I could agree with what Sayed said anymore.
And we only have about 30 seconds left. The countries to look at that we need to pay special attention to this year, is the list the same, or are you adding countries of concern?
Yeah, we have to be looking at Pakistan, Iran. Yemen goes far off the radar. This is al-Qaeda's one of their new areas, and as well as Somalia, where Shabaab has essentially taken control over most of the south and central Somalia.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Bill, for being with us. Interesting hour.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, Kathleen. I appreciate it.
Bill Raggio, managing editor of the Long War Journal, and you can go to that longwarjournal.org or com. Either will work to find out more about what he's been working on. He's president of Public Multimedia, a nonprofit media organization, and adjunct fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, a contributor to the Weekly Standard. His coverage includes strategic and operational issues relating to the war in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, Lebanon, and more extensively in Iraq, as well as al-Qaeda's operations tactics and strategy. And he's been embedded with the U.S. Marine Corps, the U.S. Army, Iraqi Army, Iraqi Police, and also served in the U.S. Army and New Jersey National Guard. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour, and thanks to John Treader and Sherry Esser for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee, Royce Federal Plaza. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Be with you again on Monday at 9 for all things political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.